From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made, or perhaps not made, in a question. Where is everybody? For a moment, let's pretend we're all standing together in the Atacama Desert in Chile. Atacama rarely has a cloud, and there's very little human population apart from astronomical observatories. These factors conspire to make Atacama perhaps the best place on Earth to look deeply into space. So if someone out there, something perhaps, was visible to humans on Earth, Atacama is where you'd see the evidence first. But even there, even in Atacama, we're still waiting for confirmation that other intelligent life exists. We're still looking at a mystery. And so our connection this hour was really made in the year 1950. Physicist Enrico Fermi was having lunch with colleagues at Los Alamos National Lab in New Mexico when he remarked, "Where is everybody?" His colleagues laughed. They knew what he was asking. If there are trillions of stars, more than that even, and uncountable chances for Earth-like settings, why is it that we haven't found evidence of intelligent life apart from our own? Where is everybody? Where is anybody, really? Anybody besides us? This hour, I hope you'll indulge a conversation I've been looking forward to greatly. And if you're inclined, I hope you'll join it. One of the finest science communicators I know is Adam Frank, who is an astrophysics professor at the University of Rochester. You might hear him on All Things Considered on NPR. He's a co-founder of NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog and a contributor to the New York Times, among other things. So it was Adam's piece a few weeks ago in the Times titled, "Is a Climate Disaster Inevitable?" that had me thinking about this question, had me thinking about Fermi's paradox. Adam gave an idea, just an idea, about something called the Great Filter. And maybe the Great Filter for us is climate change. Maybe we're going to devastate our own species on this planet via climate change before we can figure out how to traverse the stars. And maybe that same development happens to other civilizations too. Adam Frank, welcome to Connections. It's my great pleasure to have you here.
It's great to be here.
All right, I'm going to start with this, Adam. Where do you think everybody is?
I'm an optimist. You know, I think that there's so many opportunities for life to start that I think it's out there, intelligent life, that other sentient beings are out there. But the question of, yeah, why aren't they here yet? There's a lot of work to be done with that. I mean, the people who say, I mean, we've only been listening with radio, right, for, 50 years or so. So we haven't had much of a chance to really investigate deeply all the different ways which people or, civilizations might be communicating with us. So I think there's still, I don't think we've got the point yet where we can say, like, wow, we've looked and we haven't found anything. So, there's more to be done there. But I certainly think they're out there. But the real question is, how long do they last? Right? That's our question. How long does any civilization last? Because it may be that they're out there, but nobody makes it for more than, as an advanced civilization, for more than 200 years or 300 years. And that would be kind of disturbing.
Or even 1,000.
Or even 1,000.
Or right. 10,000, which is nothing in the long run.
Right. It's nothing compared to, like, say, the life of a star. So that's really the fundamental question facing us right now. We only recently have stumbled upon this thing called civilization. Right? Homo sapiens have been around for, maybe a quarter of a million years or so. And civilization is just 10,000 years old since the end of the last ice age. And this, high-tech civilization is only 200 years, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So it's really, we just don't know how sustainable this kind of massive energy-intensive endeavor is. And maybe it's something like this, which does act like a filter, and very few civilizations make it past this point.
All right, well, let's define some terms then for the hour. First of all, we mentioned Fermi and Fermi's paradox. His question is known as a paradox simply because of the math, right? The math being that there are so many planets and so many possibilities of what we would call Earth-like planets that it feels like the odds are there is life, and yet the number of pieces of evidence we have for that are zero. Is that the paradox?
Well, the paradox also in particular, what he was asking was, if you look at, if you say, as soon as the galaxy formed, 10 billion years ago or so, when and that life began and that you started to get evolution of intelligence, it, even though the space is really big, even if they were sending out an intelligence sent out very slow ships that went a hundredth of the speed of light, you still have enough time to pretty much have those ships reach the next star system and then build new ships and then go to the next star system and the next and the next. So colonization actually, there's that wave of colonization should have swept over us multiple times by now. So that was in particular when he said, why aren't they here already? Why haven't they actually, why don't we have evidence of these waves of colonization sweeping across? So that's, the particular paradox.
Okay. And then what we are going to be talking a little bit more about is the idea of a great filter. And as I understand a great filter, it's the filter being what could block life from advancing from singular, cellular, simple life all the way to a complex civilization that can travel in an interstellar fashion.
Right. So,
somewhere between A and B, there's something that blocks that from happening.
Right.
And we just don't happen to know where that is, right?
Right. And there's multiple, right, so there's multiple steps to get to intelligence. One thing that's really interesting about life on the Earth, we've had life on the Earth for about 3.8 billion years. And, you know, we seem to be the only time that anybody's ever evolved intelligence. Now, we've seen, like, a lot of wings. You know, wings have come up a bunch of different times. Legs have come up a bunch of different times. Swim bladders have come up a bunch of times. But intelligence, and especially when you think about the dinosaurs, why didn't the dinosaurs evolve intelligence? They were around for 65 million years, and they never got intelligence. So one question is sort of, you have all these steps even leading up to us. Is the great filter back there? You know, is it that it's very hard to get multicellular animals? That's the cutoff. That's where the filter happens. It's very hard to get multicellular animals that will colonize land. Or, you know, maybe that's the filter. So if the filter is behind us, then that's kind of relatively good news, because it means at least we have a good shot of going forward for 100,000, a million years. If the filter is ahead of us, that would be scary, right? That it's the next step that really where everybody dies off.
Right. And so already this afternoon on Twitter, we're seeing comments from people saying, well, of course there is life. The numbers alone are staggering in favor somewhere of life in the universe, life that may be like ours. And again, we're not talking about human beings who sit there and play World of Warcraft on other planets. We're talking about some
bummer.
sorry to disappoint some people. But some reasonable understanding of what life would be like in a complex or intelligent fashion. And so, but I guess the part of the point is we shouldn't just assume it, that there is a possibility that we're alone if the great filter is behind us. And if life in a singular, cellular, kind of simple fashion is very common, but life in multicellular complexity is terribly uncommon, or maybe so uncommon that we passed through the great filter and almost nobody or nobody else has. It is possible that we are alone. And I don't think it's egotistical to say that it's possible.
It's all about probabilities, right? So if I give you a big bag of marbles and there's a whole bunch of different colors marbles and you are jelly beans, right? And you really love red jelly beans, right? So the question is, how common are the red jelly beans? So if I give you a bag of 100, but there's only one red jelly bean per 1,000, then you're not going to find a red jelly bean, right? And so that's really what the question was like. Yes, there are in our galaxy, there's 400 billion stars. And one of the things that we've learned in thinking about this whole process about life is that planets, where we think life always has to form, are now common. Every star you see in the night sky probably has planets around it. But what if only one in a trillion planets develops intelligent life? Then basically that bag of marbles that is the galaxy, you can go through them all, and sorry, none of them are going to have life in them because intelligent life, because the probabilities are just lower than the number of planets that you have, at least like in the galaxy. So the question is, what is that probability? And what you can do is you can break it up. Every one of those steps has a probability with it. And in the end, what the great filter tells you is that in the end, it'll tell you the odds are 1 in 1,000, 1 in 1,000,000, 1 in 1,000,000,000,000, 1 in 100,000,000,000. And here's the thing. If the odds are so small that you run out of stars in the visible universe, then we're alone.
Very interesting stuff from Adam Frank here. But again, we're hoping at least that the
right.
great filter is behind us. But at the same time, if it's in front of us, then it could be many different things. It could be that civilizations, when they develop technology, tend to develop weaponry and maybe sort of self-immolate before they can travel. Maybe it's, as you write about, climate. So, we're going to get into that in just a moment, but let me pose one other possibility, which is bizarre, but I just read it this week, that a great filter may be behind us and in front of us in the form of dark matter. Here is New York University geologist Michael Pampino. In a recent paper, he wrote that dark matter could be responsible for wiping out the dinosaurs. He writes that there is a lot of dark matter in the Milky Way, and perhaps dark matter is not evenly distributed, but instead occurs in dense clumps, and maybe our solar system passes through clumps of dark matter every once in a while. And that could heat up the Earth's interior, cause a cascade of volcanic eruptions, or even knock a comet or two into our surface. Boom, dinosaurs gone, great filter, then redevelop life. Here we are today, and somewhere, whether it's 100 years, 10 years, a million years in front of us, is another. Is it possible? Is that a possibility that we're bumping into dark matter clumps?
Well, you know, that paper, when it came out, a bunch of us sort of thought it was very interesting. Actually, we're inviting him up because both the geologists are interested in this and the astronomers are interested in this. So it's possible. I mean, the thing about dark matter is, you know, we know so little about dark matter.
Do we know it's real?
You know, even that, it's the best bet for explaining what we see, right? I mean, so, you know, we can go on for a while for dark matter. But, you know, there's evidence that something like dark matter has to exist. The other thing you could do is you could completely just change your theory and say, look, we don't need dark matter. We just have to change what we understand about the laws of physics. That involves so much heavy lifting that everyone's like, no, let's take dark matter. But we haven't discovered any, we have not had any direct measurement of a dark matter particle yet. So it's a very interesting time in that. So it's possible what that guy suggested was possible. And you know what you have to do is you have to put that into the category of existential natural threats, right? There's the things about the great filter. Once you get past to our point, once you get to civilization, now suddenly you start having existential threats that you brought up, right? You know, nuclear war, climate change, who knows what else, you know, you want to, you know, artificial intelligence. What
yeah,
if we create, you know, a supercomputer that basically we've seen in this movie 10,000 times, wants to, you know, get rid of us or enslave us.
Or just has no use for us.
No use for us, right. I think the whole issue of artificial intelligence is very interesting and very scary in a lot of ways, and that really needs to be thought about in some great detail. But, you know, so there's categories of existential threats that we bring upon ourselves, and then there's categories, you know, of natural threats like that. And so there's not much we can do about the natural threats.
Whether it's bumping into a pocket of dark matter or extinction-level events from, you know, I guess a comet or an asteroid.
Yeah, that's still very real, you know.
Is it true that Jupiter serves as a bodyguard for us, though, and attracts a lot of that
stuff? Jupiter is very important. Having a Jupiter-sized planet in your solar system is very important for hoovering up a lot of the debris. There's construction debris left over from the assembly of the solar system, and every solar system is going to have this. And, you know, what we can see is that early on, you know, if you look at the moon, all those craters, almost all those craters were laid down, you know, 4 billion years ago during what they call the heavy bombardment. And, you know, then everything ended. And in some part, that was because most of them had already, the comets and large asteroids had fallen. And then Jupiter was doing a good job of you know, sort of vacuuming everything up.
We're talking to Adam Frank, who is an astrophysics professor at the University of Rochester, a co-founder of NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog, the author of a couple of books, including About Time, Cosmology and Culture at the Twilight of the Big Bang. He's a contributor to shows like All Things Considered and to the New York Times. And he wrote recently about the possibility that the great filter is still in front of us. Now, if it's still in front of us, that is a concern. And I want to talk just a moment before we even dive into climate change about a very interesting paper I read about Mars and the search for life elsewhere. We've been following the progress of, you know, search for life, water, things that the rovers are finding. And I was struck by a piece written by Nick Bostrom at the University of Oxford in England. Now, he's a philosophy professor, as I understand it, who is considering Fermi's question and the great filter. And he writes that we should be rooting against finding any signs of life on Mars or elsewhere. And here's why. He wrote a piece titled, Where Are They? Why I Hope the Search for Extraterrestrial Life Finds Nothing. He writes that if we are alone in the universe, then we have reason to believe that we have already passed through the great filter. And that means, despite climate change and nuclear weaponry, we have reason to hope that we can preserve our species and our planet through good decision-making. On the other hand, if we are not alone, we're almost certainly in trouble because the great filter is yet to come. He writes, quote, consider the implications of discovering that life had evolved independently on Mars. That discovery would suggest that the emergence of life is not a very improbable event. If it happened independently twice in our own backyard, it must surely have happened millions of times across the galaxy. The effect would be to shift the probability more strongly to the hypothesis that the great filter is ahead of us, not behind us. Such a discovery, life on Mars, would be a crushing blow. It would be by far the worst news ever printed on a newspaper cover, end quote. What do you think?
Well, first of all, we have to say, you know, the whole idea of the great filter assumes that the universe is not teeming with life, right? And so that's really, you know, and it's really possible, with intelligent life, right? Mm-hmm. And it is entirely possible the universe is teeming with intelligent life. We just haven't found it yet because, like, for example, how are we looking? We're looking, you know, mainly with radio, and maybe, like, radio is like, you know, those are stone tablets to invent, you know, to advance species. So, you know, with all the discussion of the great filter, we have to fold into the idea that there may not be a great filter. It's just that we haven't you know, discovered what's going on. We haven't been invited to the party yet, you know, and there's multiple reasons why that could be true. I think that's one thing. So the stridency with which he made that statement,
a little over the top for you.
A little over the top, because we don't understand yet whether or not, and actually I'm just working on a paper now with Caleb Scharf at Columbia. I was just down in New York talking about this, about trying to put limits on the great filter, or limits on the Fermi paradox, natural limits. Like, you know, what are the parts of this problem that really we may not be seeing it because the physics, you know, it's not that they're not there. It's just there's physics involved that we can't see.
Well, how much of the universe can we even see right now?
Well, we can see the entire, we can see the all of the observable, everything that's happened within 13.7 billion approximately light years, because that's how long it's been since the universe was born. But of course, you know, the farther I look out, I'm actually looking back in time, which is an amazing concept in itself.
Yes.
So if I'm looking at a galaxy that's a million light years away, I'm looking at it as it was a million years ago. So, you know, we have to take that into account. But certainly, you know, the galaxy, we can see the galaxy's, 30,000 light years across. So, you know, we're seeing things that are relatively contemporary there. And the galaxy's a good laboratory, right? If, you know, hopefully the numbers aren't so low that there's not a lot of intelligent life just in our galaxy, our local city of stars. So I think, you know, I mean, if we saw life on Mars, I think that would be the most awesome thing we could possibly find, you know, that it would show us that this isn't rare, that at least the microbial part is not rare. So, you know, I mean, I don't take his again, I'm an optimist. So.
Adam Frank is an optimist. Let me grab a call. Paul in Rochester wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, good afternoon. Interesting conversation, one I've followed for a long time. Scientists for years and still do, they always look in the direction for matter. Our universe is made up, quote, of matter. What if there are universes not made of matter, but made of energy? In which case, it's very possible that the life that you're looking for may already be here, but in the form of energy. It'd be very hard to describe, but the theory still doesn't seem to be impossible.
Well, you know, you raise an interesting general question, which in general, when we talk about searching for life in the universe, we're always assuming it's carbon-based, et cetera. And, you know, there's some sense in what else can we do, right? I mean, it's true that, you know, we could have, you know, life forms that are based on some entire process that we could not even imagine. And in which case, we're sort of stuck. I mean, some sense, as scientists, we have to work with what we can understand, what we can do experiments with, and what we know. I mean, we can speculate forever about what's possible, but that's fun. But then one of the things I'm very interested in this whole debate is trying to keep it from becoming a science fiction movie, right? Which it naturally sort of wants to do. Like, oh, there's aliens, but they're really evil, and so they're hiding, and they're waiting until we announce ourselves, and then they're going to come and eat all our dogs, you know? So the question is whatever you want to come up with. So the question really is, what can we do with the laws of physics that we know? And we know some pretty amazing things about the universe and the laws now of biology. And almost more importantly, we understand the laws of planets now. We're discovering planets all throughout the universe. We have explored all the planets in our solar system with little, you know, robots that are rolling around, drilling holes and things. We understand a lot about planets. So what can we do with those laws, which are the most probable, right? The idea that there's some other thing that nobody's seen, that's a little bit more improbable than saying the things we do see in the universe are what's going to produce life.
Which is not the same as any sort of an arrogant, we know everything there is to know. Not by any means.
No.
You're just saying we also don't need to take the point of view that says we know nothing.
Right.
And that, that maybe one of the answers to Fermi's paradox, and by the way, there are roughly two dozen fascinating possibilities and the answers, and a lot of them are like the ones Adam just described. Some people think there are plenty of intelligent life forms out there, and that they don't want to be discovered, mm-hmm. that they understand the possible aggression that comes with being discovered. And there are some who think that we are unwise to broadcast our position and that it is dangerous. Now, you're poking fun at – you're an optimist who pokes fun at the science fiction nature of that.
Well, no, I take that one actually seriously.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, there's a great book by Greg – science fiction book by Greg Bear, and I can't remember it now. It's Lucifer's Hammer, maybe? I'm not sure.
No, it is Lucifer. Yes.
Is that it? Humanity gets, you know, a species comes and wipes us out, and that's kind of what they do. And that really, I read that a long time ago. It was done in the 80s, and it made a huge impression on me, and I think we should be careful, right? I mean, because one thing we know about natural selection, at least on Earth, is that there's predators and there's prey, and, you know, I think we might be a little circumspect. We shouldn't, you know, there's that whole Star Trek thing, everybody's peaceful, little, you know, out there, which is not quite true. We got the Klingons and the Romulans. But I think we should be a little bit careful about broadcasting our, you know, our location.
So you're not a pessimist, but you just think the natural laws of the way life works, be a little more careful.
Be a little more careful. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with being careful, right? You know, I don't necessarily want to stand and go, hey, lunch, here we go. We're tasty.
Yes. All right. Let me get Paul in Brighton. Go ahead, Paul. You're on with Adam Frank.
Yes. I'm interested in this concept that's widely endorsed by a lot of people of intelligence as something that is apart from the rest of the mechanistic universe. And this is a mechanistic universe, whether you start talking about Newtonian mechanics or Maxwell's equations that supplemented or Einstein's special relativity or the general theory of relativity or quantum mechanics. It's all mechanistic. And intelligence is just a subset. What we call intelligence is just a label. It's really just a subset of the mechanisms that occur in the universe. And why do we insist on identifying it as being something apart from the other mechanisms? We use words to describe our own activities, words such as, I want to do this, or there's a purpose to do this. But isn't that, at this point in 2015, with all the science we have behind us, there seems to be no such thing as purpose or saying, I want to do something. When a raindrop falls from a cloud and hits the ground, we don't say the raindrop is trying to reach the ground. And when it finally does hit the ground, we don't say, oh, my goodness, isn't that bad? The poor raindrop has splattered on the ground.
Well, let me let Adam wait here. This is sort of pushing us in the direction of whether free will even exists, and there's plenty of debate about that. But, Adam, what do you
yeah,
think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think there's first of all, you know, the nature of consciousness is something I think about a lot. I don't think we understand consciousness at all to a degree where you can make that kind of claim about the mechanisms and purpose and such, because we just don't really know. You know, there's the hard problem of consciousness and qualia, et cetera, that we could go on to for a long time. But I do very much agree with the idea that, you know, we should see what we're doing, this creation of civilization, as not as some sort of like super special thing. It's just another step in what sort of, in some sense, I would say what planets do. Planets, you know, in some cases will evolve life, and that life will go on to develop intelligence, meaning the ability, you know, tool-using capacities, and then they will harvest energy on that planet, and they'll build civilization. So in that way, and I think it's very good to think of it this way, it's something that's natural, and it's going to happen on a lot of planets if it can.
Another answer to Fermi's paradox is that we are the ants next to the highway, and here's why I think that's probably not true. Some people say, hey, you know, who defines intelligence? And I think that is a fair question, mm-hmm. because even if we are considered an advanced form of intelligence or life here, maybe our values or our views of what life should be, different civilizations may view that very differently. That's possible. But some people think, well, we can't even see the world for as it exists because we may be so limited. We may be like an ant building an anthill next to a highway that is unaware that there is a whole world of complexity next to it. The reason I think that we are not the ant next to the highway is because the ant is not self-aware enough to ask whether it could be doing it. At least we're self-aware enough to ask, which to me separates us from the ant.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the thing is, I mean, when we talk about intelligence, like, well, what is intelligence? You can actually define this physically in terms of physical processes, like in terms of the dissipation of energy, right? The planet had a certain level at which energy, you know, flowing from the sun and then flowing back into space, got dissipated, got turned into heat in some sense on the planet. Now, when we came along, we stepped that up. I mean, there are definite changes in the behavior of the planet. Well, climate change is one, because of our presence. And so, you know, you don't even have to necessarily try to come up with some formal definition of intelligence to see that as life becomes more complex, it changes sort of the way the systems of that make up a planet, atmosphere, oceans, etc., interact. And so, you know, there's a nice formal definition for you. And I agree with you on what you're saying about, we you know, because we know the laws of physics, we would actually be able to see the fact there's a highway there, you know, unless it's masked from us in some way, unless the people who built the highway have reason or using technologies that are invisible to us. And that's possible, but
we don't have evidence of that. It's possible. Right. We have no evidence of it.
Right.
And that is another answer to Fermi's paradox, is that we are a pawn in some elaborate experiment that a much more intelligent civilization has created. Again, We're open to it.
Right.
We have no evidence that that's the case. Let me grab another quick call, and then we're going to move toward Adam's piece that he wrote for the New York Times that takes a look at the possibility that climate change is the great filter. But this is Nancy in North Rose. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for bringing this topic to discussion.
Sure.
Because I don't know if your guest or you had been aware of the citizen hearing on disclosure held last year in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club. 5 days, April 29th through May 3rd, were 30 hours of testimony over 5 days were given by high-level government, military officials, testimony on contact and evidence of extraterrestrial presence here. And this testimony was given in front of a panel of former congresspeople.
Yes, as I understand it, there is no evidence of extraterrestrial life here. But was I wrong? Am I wrong?
Well, I would suggest checking out the Paradigm Research Group website, where all this testimony was videotaped and has now been presented, given to every member of Congress.
Okay, I've got to jump in because only because we're going to lose time in the hour here. And I understand the point that you're making, Nancy. A lot of people want to know, do we have evidence that's been suppressed, et cetera. We knew for years that Area 51 is a perfect example of a benign story, a weather machine that fell in the desert that became, and it actually, if you look at the history of Area 51, by the way, people understood right away that that was not a UFO, and then all of a sudden, one story changes things. We could go down a rabbit hole in terms of why people believe certain things, Adam, or why they would choose to believe it, but you are in this line of work. Quick response to her comments.
You know, unless they're going to land on the White House lawn and say, hey, we're here, you know, then it just becomes sort of this, it becomes a science fiction story. Well, they're hiding because they've got this other thing. And there's, you know, there's nothing, especially as a scientist, I can do with that, right? I mean, people have been saying for a long time that it's being concealed and it's being, you know, and as, you know, with any conspiracy theory, then there's nothing, you know, there's no answer you can give. So I don't think they're here. I don't think there's substantial evidence for them to be here. And if they really were here, they should land on the White House lawn. I mean, until it's like that, then it's just an endless circle of you know, well, this is why they're doing it. They're hiding. And here's the other thing. Like, here's an interesting question. People are always like, oh, there's lights in the sky. Do you see those lights? Why are those lights? Why do they have lights? If they're trying to hide, why do they have high beams? You know, it just ends up being this, you know, crazy science fiction story that so from the scientific community, there just is not firm evidence that currently there are extraterrestrials on Earth.
2 points on that. First of all, you talk about the tiny window of time that we've even been what you would call intelligent civilization. It's much more likely, given just the length of time that we're talking about, that if we've been visited, it was thousands, tens of thousands, or millions of years ago, and they stopped by and they said, "And sort of interesting, but not a whole lot happening here. We're on to something else." And then they left, and now we're here, and we go, wait.
Right.
That's more likely than that they're hiding among us.
I've always thought, like, if I was any kind of self-respecting alien culture, why would I come here? This is like, you know, it's like going to Newark, and I'm from Newark, so I can say that. You know, it's like, come on, there must be a lot of better than this backwater of the Earth. So it's hard for me to imagine that they're skulking around, hiding.
And here's a book for our audience, if you want to check out 50 Popular Beliefs That People Think Are True by Guy Harrison, covers Area 51 and many other things that are very interesting. Let's get a short break, and then we're going to dive into Adam's piece. Check out right now, just Google, is a climate disaster inevitable in the New York Times? It's Adam's piece from a few weeks ago, and it doesn't endorse the idea that the great filter is definitely still ahead. It takes a look at the possibility that what if it's climate change, and what should we do if that's the case? So we're going to talk to Adam Frank about that after this short break on Connections.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, joined by Adam Frank, an astrophysics professor at the University of Rochester, co-founder of NPR's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog, author of a couple of books, and also a contributor to the New York Times, All Things Considered, among other things. He wrote a piece a few weeks back called "Is a Climate Disaster Inevitable?" in which he looks at the possibility that a climate disaster is what prevents civilizations like ours from being the kind that can travel in an interstellar fashion. So first things first, if we accept the idea that we are an intelligent civilization, we would be on the Kardashev scale, type one or almost type one, Adam. And this actually is important because we're going to talk about energy and the impact of energy on an atmosphere and a planet. So type one civilization defined as having the ability to use all the energy on their planet. So we're not quite type one. Carl Sagan said that we're 0.7.
I don't know where he got that number from, but I would say we're, you know, it's a fraction of a percent of the incoming solar energy that we're actually able, whether it's, you know, stored solar energy in fossil fuels or actually hitting the ground, that we're actually able to put to use.
Okay, so we're not even type one. Type two is a civilization that can harness all of the energy of a host star. So our feeble type one brains, as Wait But Why, a wonderful website that looked at Fermi's paradox, says, our feeble type 1 brains can hardly imagine how any civilization would harness the energy of a host star, but a Dyson sphere would be the machine to do it, and that's worth looking up and probably spending your own hour on what a Dyson sphere is. Then a type 3 civilization would be able to access power comparable to an entire galaxy. How do you actually travel and colonize entire parts of the universe? Well, I guess you get to type 3. Anyway, let's back it up, because type 2 and type 3 are just ideas right now, and we don't know that they exist. We are not even quite type one. But when it comes to harnessing energy, Adam's piece took a look at this process. And let me read from your piece, and then you can tell us more about it. Adam writes, quote, our evolution into a globe-spanning industrial culture is forcing us through the narrow bottleneck of a sustainability crisis. In the wake of this realization, new and sobering answers to Fermi's question now seem possible. Maybe we're not the only ones to hit a sustainability bottleneck. Maybe not everyone, maybe no one makes it to the other side. So you're not saying definitely. You're saying there's a possibility that we're looking at our great filter and it's climate change.
Well, yeah, I wrote this paper because this was actually based on a scientific paper that a colleague and I published recently in the journal Anthropocene. And it really comes from, you know, because I do a lot of work in, science communication, you know, there's a lot of, I come up with the climate debate quite a bit. And sustainability in particular, you know, that whole sort of thing like, oh, it's all, you know, a hoax or something, I'm really amazed by. And what I was trying to look at was the idea that, you know, we can actually learn something about sustainability and the trajectory of sustainability by looking more generally than just at Earth, like that this is not something that's just happened to us. And there's really reasons to think about this, because what is civilization but a giant energy harvesting engine? We go out and, you know, each 10,000 years ago, each one of us, each human being had one human being's worth of energy. Today, we all have hundreds of human beings' worth of energy every time we stick a plug into the wall, right? So we go out, we harvest energy, we use that energy to build civilization. But what we have to realize is there's this thing called the second law of thermodynamics, which tells us there's no free lunch. Whenever you put you energy to work, or to, you know, you harvest energy and use it to do work, like building civilization, there's waste, there's heat, there's pollution. You just cannot, that is like a fundamental law of physics, and nobody's going to get away from it. So if you're going to build a globe-spanning culture, which is on being on the way to a type one civilization, you are going to feed back on your planet one way or another. And the idea was that maybe, you know, as you rise up the curve of complexity, this is something that happens to everyone. And more important, we can predict its consequences. We can predict, if we know the laws of planets and energy and second law of thermodynamics, we can sort of ask ourselves, what if we had 1,000 species that we'd watch go through this? Can we, you know, look at their trajectories? Some are going to die off. Some are going to make it to sustainability, and learn things about the trajectories that led to sustainability.
Okay. And so, when we talk about, some people like to say, hey, we don't know so much about life elsewhere in the universe, and we shouldn't assume that every planet would be like ours, every form of life would be like ours. Therefore, the circumstances may be different. There's plenty we don't understand. You're saying the law of thermodynamics travels.
Yeah, it has to. I mean, this is what people have to understand, which is so awesome and so cool, is that you know, we understand planets really well. You know, our understanding of climate change on this planet doesn't come just by looking at the Earth. It's because we know Mars's climate. We know Mars's climate for the last 4 billion years. We can see evidence of it. That's how why we believe that Mars was once wet and warm. We have Venus. We can see Venus's crazy hyper greenhouse effect. Venus should be a lot like Earth. Instead, it's like 800 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface. We have Titan, one of the moons of Saturn, which has a dense blanket, a dense atmosphere. We understand how planets function. We understand why there's a greenhouse effect, how it changes. We understand how the greenhouse effect will interplay with the geosphere and the oceans. You know, geosphere is like the top layer of the crust that we interact with. So these things are universal. You can't magically change them. Now, you can say, like, well, if the planet's in a different position, say it's further away from their sun, then things are going to be different. Yes, absolutely, and we can predict what that difference should be. So this is a really amazing moment in human history that we've come to this great, you know, come to the edge of a cliff, and we can see for miles now in terms of this question.
I actually find some almost spiritual communion with other possible life in the universe, which, again, Adam has written very interestingly about the intersection of science and religion. You ought to read his first book on that, because that makes me almost feel if we are not alone, you almost feel that the life forms may be different, values may be different, the physical makeup of a planet may be different, but they may be confronting the same challenges we are.
Right.
And there's something really sort of beautiful about
that. Yeah, yeah. I think all life, you know, and sentience, the idea of, you know, like that we are the eyes of the universe, we are the universe's way of looking at itself, that every one of these species would be part of that. And people say there's no meaning in the universe. Well, no, that's not true, because we're here, you know, and hopefully others are here too. And every time sentience appears, meaning appears. And maybe meaning plays a very large role in the long-term history of the universe in that way. So, yeah, no, I agree. It has that you know, this, if this has happened before, and I really believe it does, then there is a kind of communion, so to speak, between us and them in facing these issues.
That doesn't mean, by the way, that there's not value in trying to think about this as a problem to solve. And I want to actually play a cut here, a sound clip, Adam, because all of this reminds me, you may laugh, of a movie line. You see, there's a film about confronting something that either doesn't exist at all, or if it does, seems like it will destroy us. See, that's what we're talking about with climate change. But in this film, you've got half the people in the film saying this is not really happening, and the other half saying we're doomed. And then the moment comes when the film's heroes have to make the case that it is worth fighting, even if the chances of beating it are small. Let's listen to the parallel between climate change and Gozer.
Enough! I get the point!
But what if you're wrong?
If I'm wrong, nothing happens. We go to jail, peacefully, quietly. We'll enjoy it. But if I'm right, and we can stop this thing, Lenny, you will have saved the lives of millions of registered voters.
That, of course, is Bill Murray from Ghostbusters. You like the parallel?
I love the parallel. It's awesome.
Now, I feel like you're the one telling us, hey, Adam Frank says, if I'm wrong, all right, nothing happens. Nothing. But if I'm right, and we can look at climate change and maybe do something,
right,
maybe the great filter is circumventable if we really get our act together. Are you optimistic that if the great filter is climate change, that we could beat it somehow?
Oh, yeah, I'm very optimistic. It's, you know, because really, all we have to, this is not that hard. We have to change infrastructures. Big deal. Human beings have changed infrastructures a bunch of times. Look at it this way. In 1890, you're walking down the street in 1890. How many gas stations do you see? None, right? Go 30 years later. How many gas stations do you see? They're all over the place. I mean, you know, we can invent technologies that don't have as strong an effect. Though, let me say, and here's the important thing to understand, every technology has a feedback, right? So there was a very interesting recent study, which I quoted in that piece,
yeah,
that, you know, if you tried to reproduce this culture with wind energy, like, you know, you put wind energy everywhere, you would still have some feedbacks. They wouldn't be as bad as a fossil fuel-based civilization, but there would still be feedback. So we have to understand that. And really the thing is now, we are at the end of our childhood. That's what we have to see. When it comes to this whole question of the great filter, we have been children up until now. You know, and when you're a child, you know, you don't have any concerns. Your parent takes care of you. You do whatever you want. And then you become teenagers and, you know, you start to get some power over yourself. And then you get the keys to the car and you can easily drive the car off a cliff, right? But if you mature, you gain some self-control and you're able to make more wiser decisions, make wiser bets on your future. And this is, I believe, actually, this is, you know, throughout the universe, this there's a moment of childhood end. You know, to quote, this is that's a great novel by science fiction novel by Arthur C. Clarke. This is the end of our childhood. It is time for us to recognize where we are. We're on a rock, you know, orbiting a star, and that rock has rules. There's rules about how a planet operates, and we either work with it. We can't dominate it. We're not a type one civilization yet. We can't dominate it. We've got to shepherd it. We're moving from a planet that basically did whatever it wanted to now we're shepherding the planet. And so this is the key moment. This is the bottleneck we're working through. And of course we can do it. It's just a matter of whether we do.
And it may be hard, because we would have to confront things like, what is a sustainable population number?
Right.
You know, what energy sources are accessible and what are the costs of them and what should the rules be when it comes to consuming them? Now, you are working, as I understand it from the piece, with someone from the University of Washington.
Yep.
So can you tell us about what you're doing?
Woody Sullivan. And actually, you know, the interesting thing about Woody is now just retired. And when I was a graduate student at the University of Washington, that's when I first met him. And what's funny is that at the time, he was working on SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And this is 1986. And it was still sort of like, SETI, you know. And all of his colleagues were, you know, sort of snickering. But that was before the great revolution in astrobiology. In the 90s, we recognized that we had enough data to start asking questions about not necessarily intelligent life, but just life in general in the universe. And NASA started putting a lot of effort and resources towards studying that problem. And that was when we started discovering the extremophiles, these bacteria that can live in places we thought no life could exist. And, you know, before the great revolution in discovering planets orbiting other stars. So then he became the head of their astrobiology program. And it was great to see Woody, you know, become. And now everyone's like, yay. But so the interesting thing about what Woody and I, we've always been thinking about this idea of unintentional consequences for intelligent life, and particularly not only consequences in terms of how you might observe a planet, right? It's possible we might be able to observe extraterrestrial intelligence based on their pollution. Right, that's actually a really interesting idea that they're putting stuff into the atmosphere. You know, maybe they're not trying to communicate with us, but if we observe their atmosphere, we can tell. Oh, you know, that stuff would never be there unless there was industry or something. So as well as the unintended consequences in terms of where you take yourself, right? You know, which is this is climate change is an unintended consequence of civilization building. So where we're going now, the next step. I'm working with another person at Washington, a woman named Marina Alberti, who's a city theorist. She studies urban areas, and so we're working now on this idea of what we call either the hybrid planet or the shepherded planet, that word I just used. And we're trying to understand, we want to sort of, you know, go beyond the sort of Karadash, if I can pronounce it right, the Karadashov.
Hold on, the Kardashev?
Kardashev, thank you. The Kardashev scheme. Because that's sort of like, you know, the idea of using all the energy on a planet, that's a lot. But clearly we're making some kind of transition. People talk about the Anthropocene, which is the end of the current geological era and the new era we're starting, where human beings are the main drivers of the forces, you know, the evolution of the planet. And that's pretty clear that we're pushing in that direction. So where are we heading? And so one of the things we're trying to work on is this idea that we're heading towards a shepherded planet, that we're going to have to learn the rules of planets in order to become sustainable, and so what that looks like.
When are we going to see more from you on that?
That's hopefully something I got to finish for the next 2 months. By June, I hope to have working on that paper, and I'm working on a paper right now where I can predict what the probability is, what that number is, that either we're alone or we're not alone.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I'm so really psyched about this.
Will you promise to come back periodically and just revisit this?
Yes.
Before I get back to our listeners to finish the hour, one more point I want to make here, because it's interesting that in the last 5-6 months, so much has been written in different sources about this. Christmas Day, everybody, at least in the social media world, was sharing a piece that was curiously not written by a scientist, but published as an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal. The piece was written by Eric Metaxas. I don't know him. He wrote a piece, though, called Science Increasingly Makes the Case for God. Now, Adam is someone who's written about the intersection of science and religion. And so here is what Eric writes in his piece when he looked at Fermi's paradox. He writes, quote, "Astronomer Carl Sagan announced that there were two important criteria for a planet to support life, the right kind of star and a planet the right distance from that star. Given the roughly octillion, one followed by 27 zeros, planets in the universe, there should have been about a septillion, one followed by 24 zeros, of planets capable of supporting life. With such spectacular odds, the SETI program, launched in the 1960s, was sure to turn up something soon. Scientists listened with a vast radio telescopic network for signals that resembled coded intelligence and were not merely random. But as the years passed, the silence, the great silence from the rest of the universe, was deafening. Congress defunded SETI in 1993. The search continues with private funds. As of 2014, researchers have discovered precisely bupkis, zero followed by nothing. What happened? As our knowledge of the universe increased, it became clear that there were far more factors necessary for life than Sagan supposed. His two parameters grew to 10, then 20, then 50, and so the number of potentially life-supporting planets decreased accordingly. As factors continued to be discovered, the number of possible planets hit zero and kept going. In other words, the odds turned against any planet in the universe supporting life, including this one. Probability said that even we shouldn't be here. The author then concludes with the answer for why we're here: God. Adam Frank?
I'm only saying that, you know, this is not.
It's a very weak piece if you actually dig into it, but everyone was sharing it. So right. I wanted to bring it up with you because right. I know you've thought about some of this.
Because, you know, that's not the. My raspberry there is not about the existence of God or not. That's a whole different question. But first of all, we've never done a detailed study of. The government would never fund NASA, that was, or fund SETI. That was the problem. We tried to get a bunch of SETI projects off, and they were immediately slammed as looking for green men. We've never done a whole sky. Think about what you have to do, if just with radio, if you want to look for, you have to look at all those stars, you have to look at them repeatedly, you can't just look once, right, because you don't know what the signal looks like. What radio station do you tune to, right? Everybody who's driving now, look at your radio dial, right? There's a bunch of stations, you know. Now think about, there's an infinite number of stations. There's an infinite number of wavelengths you can turn to. We have to listen to them all. We have to listen to them all for all the stars in the sky, for you know, doing it repeatedly. We haven't even begun to touch that. So, and then, of course, how do we even know it's radio? Like, why would, you know, there's optical, there's infrared, there's X-rays. Who knows what, you know, signals look like. So the idea that we've, you know, that this study has been done is just absurd. You know, it's just not true.
I think that's well said. All right. So as I go to your comments to close the hour, Adam Frank, your best guess, great filter behind us or in front of us?
In front of us.
In front of. I'm with you that it's in front of us, but you are saying it's in front of us, but it could be circumvented.
I think it's going to be circumvented. Yeah.
Okay, see, I like the optimism there. Jake writes, what does your guest think about the James Webb Telescope and other cutting-edge optical methods under development for planetary discovery, such as the idea of space-based shades to increase what we can see?
I'm totally excited, and I'm depressed because some of it is going to happen after, like, I'm retired. I'm now old enough where, like, you know, they're planning missions that either I'm going to be retired or I'll be dead. So, no, it's totally awesome. And, you know, we're not doing, again, when you look at the money that we're spending to do space exploration, it's ridiculous. You know, there's more spent on potato chips per year than we spend on looking around at the universe. It's crazy.
And John and Webster, try to keep it as brief as you can. John, go ahead.
Thank you, Evan. I'm really enjoying what the press has to say. Two things. You mentioned about the intersection with God. There is a marvelous book that I bought in 1965 in Great Britain by Professor S. L. Frank, a Russian philosopher, and his title is Reality and Man. And he talks about that intersection through reality in the world of fact, reality in the knowledge of it, and then the reality of God in construction of the universe. My second point was that I don't like the default position that people take in assuming because we don't have an answer, then it must be God that made everything.
Those yeah.
Comments.
Yeah, thank you for the call. Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, I'm no relation to that one. I haven't read that book, but I'll look out for it. You know, I have a strong interest in, you know, how science and religion, how we can get a different kind of dialogue between science and human spirituality than the usual stuff that we see. But yeah, I agree. There's lots of ways we need to think about this, especially, you know, the role that life plays and meaning plays in the universe.
When it comes to why we do care, we've talked about that this hour. You care because you think there's something that might still be doable something that can change the outcome, I guess. Does it, and you just kind of touched on your own career, getting into retirement when all these great things are happening. But most likely, we're not going to get an answer on the Great Filter or Fermi's Paradox in our lifetime or our grandchildren's lifetime. That make you a little sad?
That makes me sad. But here's the cool thing, is that probably within 20 or 30 years, we will have the capacity to start finding biomarkers in the atmospheres of distant extrasolar planets. So we're already at the verge of being able to actually study what the atmospheric composition is like. And so within 2 decades, we're going to have machines up in space that will be able to tell whether there's ozone in an atmosphere of a planet. And it's pretty hard to get ozone in an atmosphere of a planet unless you have life. So intelligence may be harder, but I think we're going to get pretty close to at least being able to determine, you know, having some strong evidence for the existence of life on other planets.
And Adam has also said when we talked around the end of the year on Rochester's Favorite Books, you mentioned that we are still the only place that you could go outside under a sky, take a breath, and not die.
Yeah.
So that's another reason for us to say whether we're alone or not as a complex form of life. Life's still a pretty amazing thing.
It's an amazing thing, and you got to be thankful for every minute that you get.
Boy, oh boy, is that ever true. I have greatly enjoyed the hour.
Me too.
And I know how busy you are. Thanks for giving us the hour. Again, check out Adam's piece, Is a Climate Disaster Inevitable? Great read. Share it around and check out his work on NPR's 13.7 blog there that he helped co-found. And we'll see you soon, I hope.
Great. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
All right. Short break, and we're talking Alzheimer's research and the future of combating that disease next.